Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome. I'm Dr. Deborah.
Hi, it's Coach Kelly.
Coach Kelly, you've been sleeping a little bit more?
A little bit more. I thought you were going to say you look like you need sleep, because that's true, too.
Well, as a fellow sleep-deprived person,
yes,
I can tell you I understand when those days go by. I'm on a 4-hour and 20-minute run right now.
Are you still?
Yeah. Oh, every once in a while, I'll get 6 hours, 6 hours and 15. I feel like a different person.
Yeah.
I just don't seem to go into that
so
deep sleep.
So are you getting up? Or
No, I really try to relax. I'll put some lavender, you know, on my little points, you know, my wrists and stuff. And I just smell that and take some deep breaths and just calm down and relax and try not to worry too much about the up and comings of the day or
the
week.
Yes, exactly. I know that can get me into such a bad place. But you know what I think about, and I wonder if this could help our listeners too. I always think like, somehow or another, it always turns out okay. Like, I always think like, what's the worst situation? Okay, I'll be tired throughout all of it, but like, I'll still be able to get through, it'll be okay. Because I think in those moments, you're like, oh my God, I'm not gonna be able to do it. I'm gonna be tired. I'm gonna feel sick. And like, it usually somehow or the other, like you just get through it and it's okay.
Oh, you know? Absolutely. And the most important thing is not to activate the sympathetic nervous system, which is fight or flight. That's what people do that really make the problem that much worse. Because if you're lying there and you start panicking about not sleeping, then it's almost impossible to calm down.
Exactly.
The parasympathetic nervous system, which is our calming agent, that takes a lot longer to work than to rev up. To rev up quick, but we don't slow down fast. So it's tough. So I've been really working hard at
That's great.
I have the same attitude. I get up. I try to get up at the same time anyway, even if I'm tired. Take my walk, kind of boost the adrenaline or the endorphins. Try and just carry on.
Yeah. That's all
I know
can
you're
do.
Probably going to kill me for my Fitbits.
Oh,
I had 120,000 last week.
You know what? You're always ahead of me. And you're like, but I kind of like it because you're my inspiration. Because all my other friends are lazy, like couch potatoes. So I'm always like, yeah. And then I see yours. I'm like, oh, like almost, you know?
You know what's hard about it, though? Because one time I got 30,000 steps in a day. It's almost impossible to ever do that again, you know?
God.
So that's like I've set the bar too high for myself. But as you can see, you can't see this listener, but I have worn out now my second Fitbit in... since
Are
February.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, they're sending me another one. They're like, does she shower with it?
Exactly. Like,
nope. It's just wear and tear. I've actually got electrical tape on it trying to keep it together.
This is hilarious.
It is funny.
But like, how long do you walk for? Jesus Christ, 30,000?
Well, that's a lot of miles.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's about, you know, that's like 13 miles in a day. That's rare. Usually if I'm traveling and I'm exploring a new city or something like that.
You do that.
But I do average about 7 miles a day, because I usually try to get 3 to 4 miles in the morning just as a workout thing. And then I try to walk everywhere. So, you know, I'll park my car farther away from the store so that I walk a little extra. Yeah. If I'm in a store, I'll go up and down the aisles just to get the extra to see what's there. I'm just, you know.
That's great.
It's just important to me because I got some back problems. I could be an old yenta soon. Hey,
it's good
to you. Check out the new app for LA Talk Radio.
Oh, I have to look at that. I'm going to be totally honest. I definitely have to check that out because I heard it's wonderful.
Yeah, so you got to download the new app for LA Talk Radio, and it's up and running, and apparently there's going to be a new website soon as well.
That's awesome. It'd be really great. Cool. So let's talk a little bit about our last week's show, which was fantastic.
Absolutely.
We had Kim Gold. She's the co-founder of True Religion Jeans. And we also had our business partner, Derek LaSalle. Kim wrote the book called Gold Standard, How to Rock the World and Run an Empire. And we really had a great conversation. We talked about women in the workplace, balancing family and work, and kind of, you know, we had a little bit of, you know, her personal take on things. And we had her fiance, Marlon Young, to kind of weigh in as well. So it was just a really cool, like, dynamic show.
They were awesome. It was really nice. It was literally like sitting in a living room, having a glass of wine and all just chatting. I mean,
it really felt natural, didn't it?
Yeah. It was awesome. You know, also, I started to read her book.
Yes.
And, you know, I love it when people are really candid about their life story.
Yes.
So that she really gives you the picture of what her childhood was like.
Uh-huh.
And she just expresses it as is. And it's really, really It's awesome.
I know. You know. I love that too. When they're so authentic and down to earth and you just feel like, all right, this is the real deal. I like that too.
Absolutely. Yeah. So she was awesome. And an inspiration to,
oh
to women.
Oh my God. Yes.
I also found her delightful that she wasn't, you know how so many feminists are man haters?
Yes.
Which is awful. That's such a turnoff mm-hmm. to me as a woman. It's like, mm-hmm. I mean, we're all part of, you know, we're double gendered. We yes. need them both. You
yes,
know? So
exactly.
I liked her, even though she appeals more to women or writes more to yeah. women, I think she's really an inspiration to humanity.
Of course. Yeah. And a philanthropist. So I thought it was great.
And today we yeah. have Rosemary O'Connor, the author of A Sober Mom's Guide to Recovery. And Rosemary is a certified addiction recovery coach, a certified professional coach, and she founded the ROC Recovery Services to respond to the specific needs of women and mothers in recovery. She's been a workshop facilitator for Bayside, Marin, and on staff of the Altamira Recovery Programs, Muir Woods Adolescent Family Program, and Five Sisters Ranch. Rosemary serves on the advisory board of Stepping Stone, the oldest alcohol and drug recovery program for women in Northern California. Welcome, Rosemary.
Thank you so much, and thank you so much for having me on the show. Wow, I want to get that book you were just talking about.
Ah, okay.
Yeah,
that sounds good.
That sounds great.
So
yeah.
When is your book actually released? I know we have the advance copy. Is it out yet?
Yes, it is. Hazelden released it in mid-September.
Oh, that's awesome.
So, great. Yeah, about a month now, I guess. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Is this your first book?
Pretty exciting.
Yes.
Is this your first book?
It is. It okay. was. It is.
It was. You're onto the second
Yeah, and I didn't even think I was a writer or an author, nor did I ever imagine that Hazelden would want my book. So it's one of those miracles.
That's amazing.
And congratulations.
Yeah.
I know it's, you know, as a, I authored four books, and I just know increasingly every year it's harder and harder to get an actual publisher. So feel very proud of yourself because it's an amazing accomplishment. Congratulations.
Yes. Well, thank you.
So I'm dying to know, tell us what inspired you to write the book.
Well, yeah, you know, when I got sober, I was going through a divorce, and I had three kids that were 2, 5, and 8. Mm. And really, I wrote the book that I wish I would have had through all the different challenges, like I talk about in the book. You know, there's the 26 different short chapters on, mm-hmm. you know, like codependency and dating and guilt and shame. And really, you know, the reason also behind that was I wanted moms to feel like they weren't alone in any of this. And there's no shame in this disease, and there's a solution.
Mm-hmm. So glad you mentioned that, because shame is just the root of every problem that we have in this country and all other countries, right? I mean,
oh my God.
A little bit of shame is okay, but boy, that massive quantity of it where you feel just like annihilating yourself constantly, awful. So did you experience a lot of shame?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the reasons I got sober. When, you know, I thought I'd lose my kids. And I really think that's why a lot of mothers relapse, because they can't face or feel that shame that they've caused their kids. And, oh, yeah, the shame was deep.
So,
yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit, so you're sober from alcohol, or was it drugs also?
You know, I dabbled in drugs, mm-hmm. you know, years ago. But yeah, no, my main thing was alcohol.
Okay.
Lots of it.
and this was before kids, and then during motherhood partway.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And then when, I was going through my divorce, and again, the shame, guilt, and fear just took me down really quick and really hard. Yeah.
I applaud you for getting sober with three kids. Like, I mean, it's hard enough.
Kelly's thinking of starting doing drugs.
I'm not kidding you. Like, we joke about this because I'm completely overwhelmed with motherhood right now. I have two boys, 3 and 6. Yeah. And so the fact that you,
Lord.
I mean, that's just such bravery and inspiration, really.
I mean, I get it. You know, again, the overwhelm is just, again, why moms relapse a lot, or just to take that edge off, or relax. It's It's a lot. Sometimes I look back and go, how did I do it? But, you know, when an alcoholic or drug addict mother, you know, there's just eventually when your disease gets that bad, I mean, you can't function.
Yeah.
So, you know, unlike you, to have a couple glasses of wine to take the edge off, I couldn't do that. A couple just didn't do it for me.
Yeah.
So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm so glad I can do that because I'd be really sad to not. But it is, you know, it's
right,
something it's, to always watch for, right?
Of course.
I'm always cautious of that. Like, wow, okay, when is it crossing over the line?
Yeah.
I'm curious, Rosemary, did you have a pinnacle moment? Was it like just a moment in time where you just said, oh my gosh, I just have to get sober?
Yeah.
Or was it a progressive process?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I had gone on a 3-day binge. And the last day I had hired an 11-year-old babysitter to watch my kids. You know, they were 2, 5, and 8. And long story short, you know, I said I'd be home in 2 hours. I left at 7, and I said I'd be home around 9 p.m. And I got all dressed up in this fancy sequin gown, you know, the hair, the shoes, the whole bit. And bottom line, I ended up at some stranger's house, and I didn't come home. And I strolled in, still drunk, the next morning, and had gotten sick all over my gown and one shoe. And, you know, my three kids, the look of horror on their face. Because I wasn't the type of, you know, fall-down drunk mom. I was, you know, involved in the kids' school and all the things you do for your kids.
Right.
I'm very involved. And, you know, then it was the look on my best friend's face that just told me I better get my act together.
Yeah.
And then my ex-husband was there, and he gave me that look like, you better get your act together, I'm taking these kids away.
Yeah.
And so I just thought, you know, that moment, if I don't do it now, and that was about 11 o'clock after the whole scene, then they all left. You know, 5 o'clock was going to roll around in a few hours. And I knew, you know, 5 o'clock was my witching hour when I always started drinking.
Yeah.
So I made that call.
So, and you went to a recovery center?
No, you know, I went straight into AA, straight into AA, and, you know, a lot of people are fortunate they can go into recovery centers, but then there's also many that can go just straight to AA, and,
Did you do the 90 and 90, where you went every day for...
You know, I didn't do the 90 and 90, which is recommended, you know, I had three kids to take care of, and, you know, looking back, I probably could have. I certainly made plenty of time to drink. But, you know, I went to about 4 or 5 meetings a day, a week, and I'd go as often as I could. You know, I got a lot of outside help, too, from therapists and eventually a psychiatrist, because most of us have, you know, also some severe depression or anxiety or things even worse than that need to be taken care of.
Sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, good job. Wow.
Yeah. And thank you for your honesty, because
yeah.
I really think this helps our listeners. I think when people get so vulnerable and so honest, I think it really helps heal other people, because they realize they're really not alone and they're not, you know, the only ones who are suffering. So we really appreciate that.
And a reminder to our
listeners,
if you have a question for Rosemary or a comment or for either Coach Kelly or Dr. Deborah, please give us a call anytime during the show at 323-203-0815. Again, 323-203-0815. And we're talking to Rosemary O'Connor, the author of A Sober Mom's Guide to Recovery. And yes, your candidness is so special. You know, I really would love if you could talk more about the guilt process, the guilt and the shame process, and how to heal through that.
Yeah. Well, thanks for bringing that up, because, you know, like I said, it's at the deepest core of all moms around their using and the damage we've caused to our kids. And, you know, but it will go away, and there's some steps that you can take, you know, really, because it all comes down to shame. You know, guilt is, I stole the cookie out of the cookie jar. But shame is, I'm bad. I'm a bad person because I stole the cookie. And, you know, that's the lie that the shame tells us. And it goes really deep. And, you know, then there's the guilt. The guilt, we can do something about it. It's like, you know there's an answer. Stop drinking. Stop using. Mm-hmm. Find help.
Yeah.
And, you know, but it's about coming to really understanding the disease. You're not a bad person if you're an addict or alcoholic. You have a bad disease, right. And it's treatable. So the way I look at it is once you know it's treatable, it's your job as a mother to take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an answer. So, and then, you know, you learn a lot of compassion for yourself once you understand the disease. And once you start, you know, making amends to your children and you're able to show up present,
yeah.
and really be there for them, that's when the guilt can start to dissipate.
Sure,
sure.
And how old are your kids now, by the way?
Well, my oldest is almost 26, and
wow.
then my middle one's 22, and the youngest one is 18. Yep, they're all out of the house. It does happen.
Exactly.
But they come back for food and money. That does
happen. And laundry.
Them, I don't
yeah.
think.
Exactly. So, and how has that been? How has your relationship been with them, and can you talk openly about kind of what it was like, and, you know, do they have memories of that time, or...
Well, you know, my daughter has a lot of memories of us, you know, my husband, my ex-husband, my husband.
My husband. I love it.
Of us fighting. And, you know, the two-year-old had no clue. And the five-year-old, you know, who knows? But what they really got was, you know, what we call the white knuckling. When I was having to wait till like 5 o'clock, because somewhere in my mind I thought, well, you could start drinking at 5.
Mm-hmm.
The my behaviors, like the screaming, the yelling, that I didn't even realize. So they don't, again, I wasn't the type of mom that they saw drunk.
Right.
But, you know, of course, my behaviors and the divorce, of course, affected the kids. And, you know, the good thing about recovery is, oh my gosh, I have not only a close relationship with my kids, I have a real honest and open
mm-hmm.
relationship with my kids. And I think because they've seen me fall down and get back up,
mm-hmm.
They've said it themselves, so it's not that I think it. They've said that, you know, they learned that lesson early in life, that we really can face our demons, and there's a solution.
Yes. It's so true. Yeah. I think it's really wonderful when parents are honest with their kids. And I think that I like how more and more I feel like in this generation, like we are being much more honest with our kids than I think our parents were with us. And, you know, our grandparents were with our parents. Like, I think, you know, it was kind of swept under the rug and things weren't really, you know, discussed. And I feel like we're really moving in a nice direction where it's like, no, we got to be forthright. I mean, if we want our kids to be honest with us, it starts with us being honest with them.
Right. Well, and to a certain, you know, discretion, when I first got sober and I was really so excited, you know, that I wasn't drinking anymore, and I sat my three kids down and I said, guess what? Mommy's an alcoholic. Like, that was a good thing. And my five-year-old went to school, nursery school that day, and he put up his hand for share and tell, and he said, announced with great pride, like I had, my mommy's an alcoholic. So I recommend getting a lot of guidance on what to tell your kids
right.
and when to tell your kids.
That's really
good. Yeah, which, you know, I wanted to ask you because I have worked with a lot of families in recovery, and I see that you were at Altamira. I was asked to be the program director at Altamira not that long ago.
Really? And,
yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. It's
so cool.
a small world.
But I ended up working in some of the places in Malibu and running the family program, and it always came up. It was always an interesting thing is, how do you tell your kids? When do you tell your kids? What do you tell your kids? And how do you deal with their reaction to their own sense of embarrassment or unknowing really what that means and their friends? So I'm sure that you had to encounter all of that. And I know that's a huge question, but if you could break it down and share some of your wisdom, would be amazing.
Sure. And, you know, again, it's depending on the age.
Yes.
So, you know, the main thing I wanted to get across to my kids is, you know, it's a family disease. Mm-hmm. And so over the years, I would, you know, at appropriate times, I'd explain to them a little bit about the disease,
mm-hmm.
and that it's not a shaming thing. I was really open with them and then eventually their friends Not that I waved a banner, but I also, you know, their friends eventually came to me, and the parents eventually came to me. So, you know, and like they say, it's to, you know, not try to, you know, stand on the corner and try to think that you can help everybody, but to, if they reach out to you, to be available. So I got over the shame of it pretty quickly. And, you know, and again, it was just because I learned about the disease. I really got that it's not something I woke up one day and said, I'd like to be an alcoholic. Right. It was, you know, much like cancer. People don't act, they don't wake up and say, I'd like to have some cancer today.
Right.
But there was a misconception. So it's, again, it's depending on what age they are. And, you know, we, I also, we don't have to think that everybody else out there has to get sober. It's a personal choice.
Yeah, in working with people, like I understand you're the, you know, on the advisory board and you've kind of worked in these areas. Can you tell pretty quickly whether or not people are really serious about wanting to get sober?
Well, you know, like anything, you just watch their actions. And you don't watch what their mouth saying, you watch their actions. And, you know, I can... pretty much, but I'll tell you, I love being wrong. I love being wrong in that area, to say that, you know, but different people get sober different ways. And, you know, I just try to be there when other women need help. And, you know, I just have to clearly know that I'm an alcoholic and just to be more of an example. And instead of, you know, trying to figure out what other people are going to do and what they need to do. I'm just try to be the example of what works for me. And that's what I offer to other women. I can't, you know, like somebody came to me and said, you know, they were a young age at 21 and how am I going to not drink going to college? I said, you know what? I have no idea because I drank in college, but I know there's some kids out there that can tell you how to do it. So I never tried to speak out of my experience. And again, just, you know, be compassionate and loving, and not try to judge and tell them, you know, what this is what they're doing wrong. I can just make suggestions as to what works, what worked for me.
Was your husband, as you call him,
I love it,
actually supportive in your beginnings of your recovery process, or did he do anything that was sabotaging? And
oh,
you may not
no,
want to say
absolutely.
That on air, but...
He was very supportive.
Oh, nice.
Matter of fact, when I was 6 years stone cold sober, you know, I had to, that's when I did go to treatment for my depression and anxiety. And he and his wife were all set to go to Hawaii, and they just packed up the kids and took them with them. And so he was very supportive.
That's nice.
Yeah, I'm lucky. I was really lucky.
That's really nice.
Yeah, family systems that I have, many of the ones that I've worked with, although the family says that they want to be supportive, they do so many sabotaging things to bring them down, to bring that homeostasis right back to where it was so that they have an identified patient.
Yes.
I mean, you know, mom gets sober. It's like, who's dad going to point the finger at? You know, that happens so often. Such a challenge. So you're so fortunate that.
I think so, too. So I have a question about, I can imagine, you know, going through this process and going through outside counseling, were you able to get a sense of why you had come to alcohol in the first place?
Oh, absolutely. And I really think it's pretty similar for everybody. Not everybody, but one, especially women. One of the core things is, you know, I'm not good enough. So it's trying to fill that hole inside of us that, you know, says if I, you know, have enough of this or enough of that, all those outside things, I'll feel good about myself. But, you know, so it's really extreme judgment of ourselves. And, you know, just for a lot of people, really, deep dark wounds and secrets. You know, everything from sexual abuse to physical abuse to, you know, mental or emotional abuse. And, you know, alcoholics or addicts, they use the drugs and alcohol to suppress that. And so there's a lot of the inner work. And, you know, and then I truly believe it's a spiritual walk, and it's a spiritual disease. And most of the people that I see, what really works is when they can find, you know, a higher power than themselves. It doesn't matter what it is. But to really kind of fill that void,
sure,
that really nothing in the outside world can heal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah. Did you have a family history of addiction as well?
Well, let me just tell you, I'm 100% Irish, so you guess.
You needn't say anymore.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, O'Connor.
Yeah, but, you know, I come from the quote-unquote high-functioning. And I looked like a very high-functioning on the outside,
yeah,
but emotionally, you know, and spiritually, I was just dead inside,
yeah,
completely dead inside. And I tried to keep making those outsides look good, but, you know, eventually,
yeah,
it gets the best of you.
So if you could kind of give maybe just like three tips to people who are struggling, mothers or fathers, like what's kind of the three most important things do you feel like, you know, once you're in recovery, have kind of made that decision, like, yes, I want to get well. Like, what do you feel like the three most important things are?
Well, it's to get help. And I think so many women, you know, we're used to doing everything on our own and we don't need help. I can figure it out. So the most important thing is to reach out for help.
Mm-hmm.
And then to build a community around you. You know, all studies show, and I don't care what kind of community it is, not only in the recovery field, it's that bonding. It's that, you know, I identify with you. So, you know, that's why so many women have helped me through the years and continue to, that when I have any issue going on, I can reach out and get some support and guidance.
Sure.
So, and then not to say, you know, the big, huge piece is just to, you know, not drink or use.
Of course.
You know, so you got to put that down. You need help.
Yep.
And just, you know, a lot of self-love and compassion and forgiveness. And, you know, and also what I love about the women I coach and work with is to find a passion to replace, mm-hmm, all that time. And you know, when the women that find the passion, or the people that find a new passion and kind of a new purpose in life,
yes,
they really can succeed in working on a daily basis with overcoming this addiction and really enjoying their life. I thought my life was over when I had to stop drinking.
Yeah.
And it's quite the opposite.
It's nice.
I remember that when I quit smoking, I couldn't imagine that I could do any activity in the world without a cigarette in my hand. It was so
really?
Bizarre.
How long did you smoke?
Yeah.
I smoked for quite a long time, a lot in my teens,
really?
And early 20s. And then I kind of tapered off and I was a little bit of that closet smoker. You know,
yeah.
I would wait till the weekend.
Yes.
Like you wait
yeah.
till 5 o'clock. I'd
yes.
wait till the weekend. Oh, Friday through Sunday, I can smoke.
Uh-huh.
But then I thought,
yeah.
thinking about cigarettes all the time.
Oh, really?
I was
yeah.
waiting till Friday would
yes.
come.
Yes.
And my doctor finally said, you know, I don't care if you smoke a pack a day, five cigarettes a day, or one cigarette a week. It's not,
yeah.
You never know. You're playing Russian roulette. It could be one cigarette that changes your internal cellular structure.
Oh.
So don't fool yourself by
right.
thinking because you just smoke a little bit.
Yeah.
That, you know, so I mean, it was hard. I quit a couple times, but then when I finally quit, it was just, I just simply said, this is no longer an option.
Right.
Period.
Right.
Not an option.
Wow.
Yeah. The rest of dealing
wow.
with the world was an option, but that was not negotiable.
Wow.
And for some reason, it was
right.
that simple sentence. You
that
know, and learning
you.
To deep breathe in a healthy way, because
mm-hmm.
so much of addiction is about not breathing, not
yeah.
breathing in the moment and just mm-hmm. being present with where you're at, because then you live in this danger zone all the time. You're trying to run from something that isn't even present.
Right. The fear.
Right.
So would you say
right.
that stress management was also a really important part of recovery, Rosemary?
Oh, gosh, yeah, absolutely. Matter of fact, I'm doing a webinar with Hazelden on self-care.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, us mothers, us women, we run around like, you know, crazy people, the pace that this society runs at. So I really needed to learn to slow down and learn to say no to so many requests. And, you know, like you guys were talking about, you know, learning to sleep well, whether it's even a 20-minute nap, closing my eyes, you know, waiting in the carpool line when these kids were young, you know, and to feed myself well and get some exercise. We talk about HALT, H-A-L-T, you know, hungry, angry, lonely, tired. With all those, we can do pretty much one quick thing, and that really rejuvenates us in the moment.
Okay. Yeah, I think we have a society built on distractions. People learn how to distract themselves, but they do not learn how to self-soothe. So what you're talking about is so important, Rosemary, because, wow, it's just, that's the fundamental basics. We have to remember that all of us have an inner infant in us, and we have to take care of that. And we talk about an inner child, but children can fend for themselves on occasion. But we really have an infant that goes with us everywhere. We need to attend to.
Right.
So true.
Yeah.
Well, I think also, especially as a mother, like we just, our needs are really put aside because we're just focusing so much on our children and their stuff and their responsibilities and, you know, what they need. And it's really easy to slip into that pattern. We just don't, we can't, you know?
As we're supposed to. But
the overdoing, you know, the overdoing. And what I finally started to learn is, would I want one of my kids running around like I did, you know, when they're my age eventually? No, you would be telling them, honey, slow down, take a nap. You know, all this list of to-dos is impossible for one person, but yet we don't take, you know, our own advice. It's no wonder, like I say in my book, that, you know, all the kids are using drugs and alcohol because they're running around just as crazy as their parents, and they're guess who they're learning from,
right?
So self-care, that was something I thought self-care was just going to get my nails done, which I really love, but it was really more about slowing down, saying no, really treating myself as well as I treat somebody else.
It's a nice way to put
that's
it
beautiful. We're talking to Rosemary O'Connor, the author of A Sober Mom's Guide to Recovery. If you have any questions for us or for Rosemary, please give us a call at 323-203-0815. I'm so glad you're here, Rosemary.
Me too.
You have such a soft presence to you
as
well. It's very calming and soothing.
Uh-huh.
It's nice. You've done
that's quite a change, too. You can ask my husband. I didn't used to be like this.
Are you dating anybody now? Are you dating anybody now? Do you have a new relationship?
I dated over the years, and no, I still stay open. He's looking for me somewhere out there.
He is, yes. That'll be the isbend, right?
Exactly.
We had a wasbend, and there'll be an eventual isbend.
Exactly.
Yes, I like that. And, you know, the last 2 years, it's been my business and my book that I've been birthing. So now, the book's done. I think I'm more available.
Cool. Well, we have an email, and I'm wondering if we could get your opinion about it. We had an email.
Sure.
Okay. Dear Dr. Deborah and Coach Kelly, I know you're talking about addiction and being a parent today. I'm struggling, but not about me. I think my husband is an alcoholic. He won't admit it, but it's obvious. He can't go a day without drinking. When he comes home from work, I can smell that he's had alcohol. It's interfering in our lives and our kids. He's often missed events because he's been drunk. What do you do when your spouse is the alcoholic and won't admit to it, letting alone getting help? Signed, desperate for help.
Yeah, that's very common. So again, what I would tell her, the exact same thing I would tell an addict alcoholic, is to go get help. And there's lots of help out there. You know, there's Al-Anon, which is the sister program to AA, and she will find there many, many, many women going through the exact same thing, and or to seek help from an interventionist. And, you know, a lot of people, they forget to ask the person or to confront the person and say, you know, honey, this is a problem for me, not the you. You have a problem. This is a problem for me, and I'd like you to get help. You'd be surprised how many people will actually say, thank God, you know, I need help. And so that's an option, is for so many people, you know, they don't want to confront the person. Again, I think it's because they don't understand the disease.
Right.
And so you know, because again, there's still a perception of the people are bad, or it's that it's shameful. So it's like anything else, you know, to confront the person and lovingly, and then the most important thing is to take care of herself and her kids. You know, you don't want your children around a practicing alcoholic. Right. They'll put them in the car. Maybe they'll fall asleep when they're supposed to be watching the young ones. Mm-hmm. But there's, again, lots of help out there. Mm-hmm. And to reach out for it, because it's there.
It's so interesting. If our husband or somebody who we loved had a mole growing on their face that looked like it was becoming discolored or changing mm-hmm. shape mm-hmm. or that we feared was cancerous, we would speak up, right? We would simply say, hey, take a look at that. I'm a little concerned about that, yeah. right? But somehow with addiction and such, we're just become so timid about
yeah.
because we are often met with a lot of anger and resistance.
I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we know what's coming.
Yeah. I might add one more piece to that. Tell me what you think about this, Rosemary and Coach Kelly, to even take it a step further and ask her to suggest that we go get help.
Yeah.
Like as a team.
As a family. Exactly. That's a great idea.
You know,
so exactly. A lot of times, you know, the addict or alcoholic looks like what we call the identified patient. But because it really affects, alcoholism and addiction affects everybody within arm's reach. And then the family system or the people around them have to cope and develop unhealthy skills to deal with mm-hmm. the addict alcoholic. So, you know, and most of them are addicted to getting the loved one better.
Sure.
So they have some issues to look at themselves and to change. And what I do know, and maybe, you know, you're probably familiar with this too, there's no guarantee, but what I have seen is the family members and loved ones around the addict alcoholic, if they get help, the chances of the addict alcoholic getting better, the chances are so much higher.
Oh, wow. Yeah, makes sense.
Because so many people think that the loving thing to do is to do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
The loving thing to do is to be honest and upfront and say, I have a problem with this.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, to, again, like you said, face it head on.
Right.
And fill up your own toolbox along the way, right? Mm-hmm. If your husband or spouse mm-hmm. won't get help or another loved one, then working on what you can do and what you control. That's where I love the Serenity Prayer. That's like my favorite prayer. Where,
yeah.
Do you want to recite that for us, Rosemary? You probably have it fresh on your mind.
Sure. It's, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Yeah, so
you know, and that wisdom comes from asking other people for help.
Yeah,
because we don't know usually what to do in the beginning. That was like, how do I know? What's the wisdom? Well, I didn't have the answer. I had to find out the answer, and now I've got some wisdom to pass on to the next person.
Absolutely. And, you know, for people who don't believe in God, it's not a problem. Just replace that word with something. Find a mentor to help you figure that out. Find, you know, the wisdom in your community that can help you figure that out. Because people often say, well, that doesn't apply to me because I don't believe in God. But there's so much of program, you know, AA and recovery programs that use the word God and higher power. But, you know, you can replace things like, okay, my higher power could simply be love of life. It could be, you know, love of my community or my community support. It's really just finding a way to attach to something that you understand. This is a problem bigger than you can handle all on your own.
I've met people who, like, they said my higher power is Peter Pan. I've met people who said Mother Earth. I've said, you know, people in the recovery rooms are my higher power. So it's like, I think it's just the bottom line is that knowing that, you know, your higher power is not you. You know, like if you can kind of go with that, just knowing, you know, there's something else bigger that can help. So
I mean, I know many people still that are atheists or agnostics, and they still get sober. I had one client that, you know, she said, I don't believe in it. And a doorknob became her higher power. I said, go for it.
Yeah.
You know, or for me, at first was the ocean, because I knew I couldn't hold the waves back. So whatever that power was that was continuing to make them, and, you know, talk about self-soothing, the sound of the waves was very self-soothing for me. Still is. Mm-hmm.
Me too. I love that.
Yeah. A lot of people are turned away, you know, by the God thing.
Yeah.
That's talked about a whole lot.
12-step recovery is not the only way to go. It is a method, and
right.
It works for some people, and there are other interventions out there. There's different forms of therapy, mm-hmm. dialectical behavioral therapy, learning emotionally mm-hmm. focused therapy, learning how to deal with, you know, our feelings in the state that they come in, mm-hmm. and how to handle that and process that in the world. And just, you know, it's, again, whatever is going to fill up your toolbox to be able to cope with the life that you have created mm-hmm. for yourself is what's necessary. Mm-hmm. Because I know a lot of people say, 12-step, didn't work for me. Okay, then great, find another avenue.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Because
otherwise that can be mm-hmm. an excuse. Well,
yeah.
If that doesn't work, then there's nothing out there for me. And that's just not true.
Right.
And then the only thing I will say to that is, you know, that it didn't work for me, and I don't care what the it is, whether, you know, I went to therapy and it didn't work. You know, it's, you're supposed to be the one doing the working.
Exactly.
So,
yeah,
you know, it's not just going to happen to you. So, you know, if you're not willing to take suggestions from people that know the solution, then you're right. It's mm-hmm. not going to work for you. Because it's, you've got to work for it.
Right.
It's a lifelong journey, and it's kind of like diabetes. You know, you've got to change your lifestyle and eat healthier and make a commitment to change your behaviors.
It's
very similar.
So tell us, from your book, you talk about a drama mama. What's a drama mama, and how can a mother
avoid? Every radio show I've been on asks about that chapter. It's so funny. And so, you know, I would say a common trait, and I'll just say of alcoholic women or females, we just love the drama.
Mm.
And it's like, for some of us, it can be like a high, the, you know, the exhilaration of it all and the, woe is me, and you know, like for me, my ex-husband, like, you know, might have lit a small fire, and I would come in with the lighter fluid, you know, to just blow up the situation, and, you know, or if something was happening to me, you know, I'm the victim, I'd get on the phone and talk to all my girlfriends about it, and just, you know, add more fuel to the fire. And so it's, again, it's one of those tools that we just have got to learn to not over-exaggerate situations, not add fuel to the fire,
mm-hmm.
and just really look at our own part. What can I do to change this situation? But we can be very, very dramatic.
And you know, drama is another way of buffering the shame, right? If our lives are so complicated mm-hmm. and so big and so difficult, anyone in our shoes would be struggling and having trouble.
Yeah.
So therefore, it takes me a step away from feeling like something's wrong with me. So it's really a good defense against shame, but it's not a very healthy
exactly.
one.
And it's that good defense of not having to do anything with it. If I just keep talking about it, it means I really don't have to do anything to change my behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So it's back to taking ownership of my life and my recovery and how good I want to feel on a given day when I'm creating some huge drama and putting all my energy into something that, you know, I'm making complete havoc about. I'm wasting that time and energy that I could be channeling it into doing something good, like taking a nap or going mm-hmm. for a walk or, you know, creating a new piece of art, but
yep.
other than, you know, so it's about, again, switching our negative self-destructive behaviors for some positive life-enhancing behaviors.
I love this chapter. I highly recommend it. I think it's fantastic. So we are...
Now, what do you like about it? It's funny because, like I said, I'm always curious of which, on radio shows, which they like to talk about.
Okay, so on a personal level, I feel like I can really relate to this. And I love this paragraph, which I'll read. It says, when we're going into drama mama mode, we make everything a big deal. We make up stories in our head which have little to do with reality. We get everyone on our side. We get hysterical about our situation and build a big drama around it. By the time we've told the fifth friend our tale of woe, it has become an epic movie starring us. And like, that's, I think we all do it. You know, it's sort of like, can you believe that? And you're right with like the fuel. It's like, by the time the fifth friend knows, like, you know, it is like, it's created this monster of its own, you know? And it's like, I think because what happens is each time you tell somebody, they get, they're like, oh yeah, I know. Yay. And then it's like, so you keep hearing like, you got like a cheering squad, you know, and then you really feel like, yeah, 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 they really wronged me, you know? So it just becomes this kind of party of its own. I completely relate.
Right. Well, and it's exhausting.
Yeah.
You know, it's exhausting. And as women and moms, you know, I know we have a lot to do, bottom line. And we're just wasting all that energy. Mm-hmm. It's no wonder we're so tired. That's something we can control and change.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's really also a lesson in self-responsibility and accountability, but not about self-attack or blame or shame. Mm-hmm. And knowing those differences, right? They're so, so important. Rosemary, I hate to say this, but we're running out of time.
Oh, well, it's been so much fun. Yeah, I could keep chatting with you guys forever. But, yeah, thank you so much for having me on the show. And, you know, I do want to thank Hazelden for the opportunity to, you know, have this in my life and hopefully to help another woman, another mom. So, yeah, thanks again. You guys have been great.
Yeah, and I also love that your focal point is really helping your being a mother and a mother in recovery and how to help people without those specific needs, because everybody's needs are different.
Sure.
So it's nice to have a book out there that is A Sober Mom's Guide to Recovery. Pick up a copy of it by Rosemary O'Connor, a great guest she's been today.
We're so sweet.
Blessed to have you on our show and for you sharing your wisdom. I bumbled there. Sharing your wisdom. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay, well, thank you, too. Have a great day.
You too.
Absolutely.
Bye-bye.
So, awesome. So cool. Informative and so wonderful. Next week, we have a guy that I know, actually. His name is David Glass, and he is a PhD in psychology and a family law attorney.
Very cool.
He is going to load us up with all kinds of information for our listeners and for us about, you know, the horrible process of divorce that so many people go through, but the differences that one can make in those divorce processes so that you don't have to have an awful, cutthroat divorce, but the whole concept of collaborative divorce and how to create that. And
I love those combined degrees because they really could go together. You know?
And he's so helpful. I mean, I've used him a few times when I've had some sticky situations, and he's so generous in offering advice. You know, he's part of the Los Angeles County Psychological Association listserv, so we're all of us, you know, psychologists are like, what do I do? I got a subpoena or I got this. He always says, calm down. This is what you do. And he's a great guy. So that's going to be
really cool, too.
Yeah, okay.
Very cool.
All right, so
visit our website and...
And you know what? We invite you to like us on Facebook and Twitter. We got to push that.
Yes, exactly.
We got to start getting like... We should have a rally where we have to get 1,000
likes. Yeah, exactly.
Somewhere in this course of the next year.
Sure.
We're growing in our listenership, so we might as well be able to grow in our likes.
Facebooks, exactly. Sounds
whatever
cool.
that means. What a crazy culture we live in,
it's
right?
It's crazy.
You look at a picture and you tell the whole world whether you like it or dislike it, right?
But like, I feel bad for teens because it's like, that's like their whole life. Like, how many people liked their poster, you know? I mean, it's crazy. That's like what their self-esteem is based on.
What was it, 13 or 14-year-olds go check their social media 100 times a day?
No.
And that's often in response to having posted something and going and checking it obsessively to see whether anybody has looked at it or not.
This is killing me.
Right?
It's very tough.
Now, does it mean also, because you're a little bit, you're younger, so you're closer to that.
Sure.
If somebody doesn't click like, are they implying that they dislike it, or are they just not participating in that thing?
I don't think it implies that they dislike it, but I think it's sort of like, well, did they see it and not like, so it, like you get in your head, you know, did they see it and not like it purposely, or were they just busy and didn't look at it? You know, it's kind of like a lot of questions.
Okay, so visit our Facebook. Awesome. And like us.
Yes.
We're likable.
Just a little bit.
A little bit. Have a good week.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.